And we are joined now by Mark Dorson, who is the chair of the Orange County Board of Commissioners, which has about 1,000 meetings this week, also with the UNC Center for Civil Rights. And we'll talk about some variety of civil rights related issues, both court cases and bills that are moving through the General Assembly right now. But thanks for joining us today.
You're welcome. It's always good to see you, Aaron. And I love your top twisting,
cap
bubble
twisting,
fizzing.
Bubbles fizzing, moment stopping, nothing topping this feeling. Yeah, you can't see this on the air, but Mark's just like cracked up laughing when, which I assume everyone else does in the car, but Susan Brown was doing the same thing earlier. So I said 1,000 meetings, but it's two, right, for the board this
week.
Two
meetings this week, yes, but it feels like 1,000.
So yesterday was the just the regular meeting. So a lot of stuff there. You got an update from OWASA, talked about property revaluation, analysis of mental health and recommendations for how to improve mental health. And I'm not even halfway down the agenda here. So what were the highlights?
Well, it was, you know, the things you mentioned. We did get the report from OWASA on the, you know, the emergency situation. And you know, what went wrong and what we can hopefully do, what went right in at least responding to the emergency. You know, the board had several questions about whether the two precipitating incidents were linked and whether there was a causal connection. And then we got just to the annual OWASA report and update, and there were several good questions and comments from the OWASA board members from the county about how we can do more to bring our values of social equity into how we provide utilities and pay for them for folks in our community who may not be able to as easily afford them.
Was that conversation related to the water crisis, or is it just
not,
had OWASA here?
It came out of the crisis because one of the things that was mentioned was the work IFC had been doing to, you know, to help provide folks who had lost their water.
Mm-hmm.
I had asked the question about what OWASA could be doing directly in order to help those, you know, most vulnerable to this situation and least likely to be able to manage the costs of the utility. And they explained that they read their enabling legislation very narrowly and that they can't do anything directly, but they have tried a variety of programs to encourage community giving that I don't think anybody thinks have been as successful as any of us would have hoped.
Mm-hmm. So what are the lessons learned going forward? Do we know now what they are, or are we still waiting for more info to come back?
According to OWASA, they got two consultant reports that that they commissioned right after the crisis. One, the water main break related to sort of how the pipe had been constructed, and so there, I think there are questions as to whether or not there are other particularly vulnerable pieces in the infrastructure that need to be identified. And so they're continuing to look at those reports, and hopefully we'll come back with recommendations about how those could be anticipated or avoided.
Yeah, so this is still an ongoing conversation. We're going to be talking about this for a while, right?
I think so, yes.
What do you expect to come out of this, if anything?
Well, one of the things that, you know, I think we did a good job responding to the crisis.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that the sort of response was good. You know, I think that, again, it just the sort of two precipitating incidents happening so close together, one being related, one sort of being an error with the fluoride, the other being kind of an infrastructure failure,
mm-hmm.
really leads lots of us to question or ask questions about how we can anticipate, the infrastructure issues in particular. Sort of, can we identify, are there prospective ways we can identify the problems? It sounded like there was at least someone at some point in the history of OWASA was aware that this particular pipe had been built in a way, constructed in a place that made it particularly likely to fail. So are there other places in the system like that? And if there are, how do we identify them and how do we address them in advance, I think is a big thing.
Yeah, that's a good point, because I was reading one of the initial reports that came back, and they were saying, well, this particular pipe was likely to fail because it was just barely below the ground, right, or something along those lines.
Right.
We knew that, so, yeah.
And so, you know, what can be done to identify
exactly.
other places like that where there are, you know, because of necessity, were set up in a way that makes them, you know, I think Ed Kerwin from OWASA said these pipes are supposed to have a 60 or 70 year life.
Mm-hmm.
This one had a 45-year life, but the failure of that pipe was anticipated along the line, it's, you know, by folks who had looked at it.
Speaking with Mark Dorison, chair of the Orange County Board of Commissioners, that was item number one on the agenda. So what were the other highlights?
Well, we did get another, we did get a good report on the revaluation. We're trying, because when you talk about taxes and property taxes, it's a very sensitive issue. It gets, people are very interested in that. We're trying to make sure all the information gets out as frequently and as clearly as possible. So that process is now really in the final stages. The valuation notices are going to go out in the next 2 weeks, and including how people can appeal or if they have questions or concerns.
Are you expecting a lot of emails in the next 3 weeks?
Absolutely. I think it's typically these had been done every 4 years in Orange County, and because the 4 year fell right at the recession, the commissioners determined to delay for another 4 years. So it's been 8 years since folks have gotten them. There's lots of, you know, new folks in the community who have not been through that.
And 8 years is the maximum, right?
That's right.
Counties
can either do it every 8 years, and then they have the discretion to do it every 4 years if they choose to. But I think the results, you know, what we heard from Dwayne Brinson, the tax administrator, is that the process went very smoothly. They fell within all the ranges prescribed in best practices. And I think the thing to remember is that in a reval year, we're required to have a revenue neutral tax rate. Mm-hmm. And what that means is that that is the rate based on the overall average and total, you know, the average of all the properties. And what that means is for some people, they may be paying more taxes, and in some people, they may be paying less taxes. Mm-hmm. So remember, people forget that, you know, how much tax you pay is based on two factors. One is the rate that the commissioner set every year. The other is the value of your property, which gets set every 4 or 8 years. And so, in this case, it may be possible that the tax rate goes down. But if your valuation has gone up significantly, then you might be paying more taxes.
Are there, and I don't even know if you got this from that initial overview, but are there people in Orange County or property owners who are going to see like a really significant shift in their property value, either up or down?
I think I don't know really significant, but
okay.
I think there will be, people will see shifts, up and down. I think particularly the biggest changes that we see were in the value of apartment complexes. But there's good information on the county's website that was presented last night that sort of shows how you can't look up your property yet.
Right.
But there is the general guidelines and also the ranges and parameters that they've seen.
If it's apartments that are going up in value, I assume, then apartment renters in a year or so might start seeing that reflected in their bills.
That's certainly possible. I mean, I think it's a reflection that the recent trend has been to higher end apartments. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah. Speaking with Mark Dorison, Orange County Board of Commissioners, again, orangecountync.gov if you want more information about that meeting. There's an upcoming meeting with the Hillsborough Town Board. What's going to be going on there?
Well, the commissioners have meetings with each of our colleagues in the towns over the course of the year. And really, this is an opportunity for the two boards to just have a conversation, to be in dialogue and almost more like a work session, but to really share concerns, questions, and ideas about what's happening in our, both in our different spheres and really, you know, in that centerpiece of the Venn diagram where our work overlaps. So I know some of the questions are, of course, about the coming new developments in Hillsborough, impacts on schools, impacts on traffic. Economic development. We've got a Hillsborough Economic Development Zone, as well as the burgeoning economic development in downtown. So lots to talk about, and looking forward to that.
It's just always fascinating how all of these issues interrelate with each other. We're talking about population, economic development, transportation, and affordable housing, and you can't talk about one without talking about the other three.
That's the most important insight, I think, we could get out to people. We compartmentalize so much of the work we do because it requires a level of expertise. So you have, you know, transit folks over here and housing folks over here and school folks over here. But, you know, it's like a jello mold. You press on one side, the other side, you know, pops out. So
yeah,
we have to be thinking about how all these pieces fit together.
And I'm trying, I was speaking with Mark Dorison, who's also with the UNC Center for Civil Rights, and I want to segue to that side of that hat that you also wear, but segueing it in terms of the connection between issues, because I'm thinking about intergovernmental relations and having a meeting like this with Hillsborough to try to maintain good relationships between municipal governments, which was so important. And we saw that when there was a water crisis with Owassa, and all of a sudden here comes Durham, here comes Hillsborough, here comes Chatham, and they're all chipping in and helping out because of this established relationship we've got. Meanwhile, in Carrboro, and I was talking with Lydia Lavelle about this a couple of weeks ago, and I'm still struck by their decision to, because we don't know if people are getting the message that, hey, there's water coming out of your taps, but it might be contaminated, don't use it. So they send police officers door to door, which they can do in Carrboro because it's a small enough town, but they send police officers door to door in Carrboro. And how important is it to have already established good relationships between police and the community, that when you see the police officer come into your door to knock on it, you open the door and you welcome them and you listen to what they have to say, which raises the issue of sanctuary cities, which the General Assembly is dealing with right now. And the reaction against that is, if we have to change our policing in such a way to break those community ties, it's not going to make our community more safe. It's going to make it a lot less safe.
That's exactly right. And, you know, that's a perfect example of how the, you know, all the pieces fit together.
Yeah,
and
I think it just covered like literally every issue that we're in.
Yeah. You know, one of the things about the police, and particularly with, you know, the immigrant community, and, you know, historically with any excluded community, you know, with African-American community for a long time in our country and still today, is not only are the relationships between those excluded communities and the government, whether that's the police or the local government, strained, but that increases the vulnerability of those communities, right? Mm-hmm. So if you live in a community where folks are afraid to call the police, right, that's also a community that is going to be vulnerable to being victimized, mm-hmm. For crime, or at you know, potentially most marginalized when there's an emergency like the Owassa emergency that you were describing. And so you know, thinking about and you know, the role that schools play in dealing with our immigrant families is really a critical one, because mm-hmm. You know, probably next to police, the schools are the closest to the people, the most direct interaction that they have with the government. And so really thinking about how we, you know, maintain, build, enhance those relationships, and then not only so that they work, that is the schools work, or that the police works, but also so that they can become resources to connect those communities with other vital aspects of government, whether it's health department or social services, yeah, or access to jobs or any of that.
I was thinking about health today, and it's not even just the health department. Like if you're a member of that community and the police come to your door to say, don't drink the water, and you don't open the door and you don't get the message, you drink the water and God forbid, in this case, it's contaminated, you're not going to call 911 because you're afraid of dealing with the hospitals. You're afraid of dealing with public health authorities, and it just compounds on itself like that.
That's right. And, you know, at the center, we're doing work in some communities where there have been a lot of issues for immigrant kids and their families in the schools. And, you know, as a community lawyer, one of your first strategies is to try to get a meeting, right? Let's mm-hmm. get the community and the local government leaders, whether it's the superintendent or the principals, together, you know, and let's have folks come together and talk. And what we have found in some of the immigrant communities we're working with, they don't want to go to a community meeting, right? They don't want to go to the equivalent of the Lincoln Center. And so, you know, the issues in the schools are left to fester because of these other implications.
This Sanctuary Cities bill that's going through the General Assembly, if it passes, will it affect, or do we even know if it's going to affect, Orange County, Chapel Hill, Carrboro, Hillsborough?
Well, one of the questions is, you know, as far as I know, there is yet to be a kind of clear legal definition of what is a sanctuary
right.
city or a sanctuary community. And so so it's hard to say what the implication is. But I think all of the communities in Orange County and Durham and other places that have adopted resolutions in support of the immigrant communities and adopted resolutions about not turning our local police departments into agents of the INS I think those are the communities that are being targeted by this kind of legislation.
Yeah.
So exactly how it'll fit together, I don't know, but I certainly feel our community in the crosshairs.
Speaking with Mark Dorison, Chair of the Board of County Commissioners, UNC Center for Civil Rights, got to let you go in a second, but before we do, I want to get your thoughts on the court fight over the voter ID bill, the election reform bill from 2013 called voter ID, which is potentially still going to the Supreme Court, even though Governor Cooper and Josh Stein withdrew the state's appeal. There is still an outstanding appeal. Supreme Court could still take it, so the court fight's not over. What are your thoughts about the withdrawal of the appeal on the state level? Does that have an impact on what the Supreme Court might do in terms of taking the case or ruling one way or the other? And since this is a national issue and you got to assume the Supreme Court's going to be taking some case like this sooner or later, is it maybe better for progressives for them to take it now when there's 8 justices versus in 3 months or more when there's 9?
Well, I think if it's going to go up, I think it'd be better if there's 8 justices mm-hmm. than 9, certainly, because I think if the justices split 4-4, then the Fourth Circuit's ruling would stand. I applaud the governor and the attorney general for taking this step. I wish they had taken it even sooner, but I understand how the process has to work itself out. You know, I was still hopeful for a while that there might be a 2017 election. I think the timing at this point is that is starting to recede mm-hmm. a little bit, although it would still be ideal. I mean, we're still existing under a state government that the courts have determined is unconstitutional.
Yeah. And we're waiting for the Supreme Court to decide whether to take the case, right?
That's
kind of
right.
Surprising that they haven't made a decision on that.
That's
yet.
Right. And maybe they are waiting for that, you know, yeah. for that 9th justice or that 4th vote to grant cert. There's a couple of other cases across the country that are also working their way up. Some people have theorized that they're waiting for a couple of them to come and they'll pull them all together mm-hmm. and do it all at once. I don't know if that's true or not. But, you know, I try to remain optimistic. But this is a Supreme Court that, you know, just a few years ago gutted the Voting Rights Act. So, mm-hmm. I don't want to be naive about it.
Yeah. All right. OrangeCountyNC.gov is the county's website. You know, the Center for Civil Rights website? I don't have it off the top of my head.
I think it's UNC Civil Rights.
I'm looking it up. We're so illiterate when it comes to what website here. All right. No, it's not. Oh, here it is. Law.unc.edu, and then you can search for the Civil Rights Center there.
There you go.
All right. Mark Dorison, thank you so much.
Always good to see you, Aaron.